And in addition, for those that are not yet aware and want to learn and want to be more involved, yashar koach for coming. The beginning of Parshas Yisro, we are reintroduced to Yisro, and at least three, maybe four or five times, Yisro was referred to as Hossein Moshe, the father-in-law of Moshe. And the Mefarshim point out right away that Yisro referred to himself as Hossein Moshe, as the father-in-law of Moshe, because that was the greatest kavod that he felt for himself, that I am the father-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu. For us, it is the greatest kavod that we have a chevra kadisha, that Baruch Hashem has been going on for many, many decades in our Beis HaKnesses, and we are extremely proud that when we talk about Shomrei Torah, we have a chevra, and that is so, so special, Hossein Moshe type of way. We learn a different aspect of kavod as well from our parsha. The Torah tells us, Vayetze Moshe likras chosno, Moshe himself goes out to greet his father-in-law. Vayishaklo, he gives him a kiss and a hug probably. Vayishalu ish l'reyu l'shalom vayivo ola. And everybody, because the Moshe goes out and gives the proper respect to Yisro. And as they're eating the meal, and they mention all the people that are involved in the meal, Moshe's name is missing from that episode. So Rashi writes, Moshe Eichan Haya, where was Moshe? Moshe was serving the meal himself. Because those that deserve the greatest kavod are those that get involved. Literally roll up their sleeves and get their hands dirty. And that is everybody here today. Those that are the members of the chevra, or those potential that want to get involved in the chevra, the greatest members of the kavod, which is everybody here, deserves the greatest kavod for coming out and being involved in kavod ames. You deserve that kavod yourself, and kol kavod for everybody to come in. It's a tremendous chus that we have, Rabbi Zon. Rabbi Zon has been involved in chevra kedishas for over 50 years. And it's a tremendous chus to have him in our shul. To be honest, I heard Rabbi Zon, Yishev Refuah Shleima, unfortunately had an illness last year, and Baruch Hashem, he is continuing to teach communities literally worldwide about Kavod Ames, and we're so proud to have him in our shul and in Fairview. Big thank you to our sponsors for this evening. Thank you to Abe Renee for sponsoring Lili Nishmas, Rabbi Israel and Sarah Fishweiker, who really, getting to know them a little bit in the beginning of my time here, they really represent kavod. Anytime I had anything to say of Torah in the minyan downstairs, Rabbi Fishweiker was the first person to run over and say, "Shkoach, that was amazing." It probably wasn't amazing, but him being a rabbi himself, he knew the way to make a young rabbi feel good was to say, Yashar Koach. And Rebbetzin, right, Sarah Fishweiker, was dignified in every way, in her whole persona. So it's so fitting for Abraham Renee to sponsor the Iloi Nishma's son. Thank you to Yanush for setting up, and a big Yashar Koach to Ari, Yosef, and Chevy for heading all the Chevra Kadisha needs. As we know, Rabbi Yudin always says that it's never a convenient time for this to happen, and it's really at any moment's notice. And Yashar Koach to everybody. And I'd be remiss if we don't mention two people right now. I sent over to Rabbi Zon our minhagim of our Beis HaKnesses that was put together by one of the original members of the Shmira, of our Chevra Kadisha, and David Stern, Alav Shalom, whose yurtzeit is this week. So it fits together. Rabbi Liefer came over yesterday to say the Kelmali in Shul. And also Leo. We miss him so much. The head of Chevra for, I think, over 30 years. And it's in their zchus that we are really here today with Baruch Hashem, over 50 people in the room. Yashar Koach, Rabbi Yudin and Chevy for coming, obviously, and Rabbi Belzon. That's a kavod rab that you're here as well. So, leave it to Rabbi Zon. At one point, we'll take a break in the middle. We'll figure that out. There are refreshments in the back. Rabbi Zon told me to say, you can go over in the middle and please partake. write notes. We are recording it as well for those that can't make it or those that want to review afterwards. Have a rest.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure. I'm supposed to be here tonight. I feel very close to the shul. Rabbi Yudin and I have spoken many, many times. I have to give Rabbi Yudin a very special yashar koach because he always called me the night before Zayin Adar, the week before Zayin Adar. And I'm sorry, week before Parshas Vayechi. Zayin Adar sometimes too, but Parshas Vayechi. In the last few years where we have our program, always interested in what we are doing, what could he say, and participating and using his program on radio to promote it. So it's a tremendous yashar koach when you put in kochos and you work on something and you know that there are people who take it and run with it and use those ideas and promote it and explain it and teach it. It's a tremendous, tremendous chus. But Yibad l'chaim, I must say that Leo and I and David Stern and I spoke many, many times over the years as well. And I feel very close to this shul and to the Chevra Kedisha specifically. So it's a tremendous chus to be able to be here. It's a chus to be able to be here because a year ago I was barely able to move. I'd had a stroke. Never thought I'd be sitting in, even sitting. I was always up there standing. I used to stand for hours, but I can't do that anymore. But at least I'll try to get up when necessary and be able to demonstrate what needs to be demonstrated. I don't want to take too much time. Just, again, out there, there are a few handouts. I don't think there's enough to go around. You're welcome to, we could send you, I think we sent to Yosef PDFs. He can forward them to you. You can print them out yourselves. The one thing that is not for taking, unless it's ready to take it, there are a few books that we put out there. The Afterlife book I'm going to leave as a gift to the shul. If anyone has, we received a donation of hundreds of these books, meant to be able to be given to people who would read them who don't know anything about the afterlife, to whom it might make a difference as to whether they're going to choose kfura or cremation, chas v'sholom. If anyone wants any of the books out there, you can leave them, you can see them. The only one we charge for is cremation or burial, the Jewish view. Otherwise, they're free. We just send them to you for free, maybe postage, but whatever it is. If you know anyone who you want to give it to, please call our office, email us, do something, and we will get it to you. The goal is, so let's get started. Chesed Cholemes is different than other things, other chasadim. It's a responsibility that is really a responsibility of every single Jewish person. The Gemara tells us when a person dies in the city, no one's allowed to work. Everyone in the city becomes responsible to see that that Jew is buried. Now, you know, today it's almost, we don't think like that, but you had a little shtetl. There were a few hundred Jewish families. Someone died. The halacha is everyone must stop and take care of the poor. Not only the family, whoever it is, you must take care of it. Even if you're working for someone, you're getting paid, that's the halacha. Everyone passes like this. Why don't we do that? Because the Gemara goes through a whole story. That happened, I won't be marach. The end of this, chabur, so it could be, there's a Chevra Kedisha in the city. The Chevra Kedisha takes the responsibility away. If you think the Chevra Kedisha only does chesed with the dead, it does chesed with the living. Because if it wasn't for you, everyone in Fairlawn would have not flyers to stop in there doing and make sure that the person gets buried. So you take away that responsibility from everyone else and you assume it. Okay, but it's different than the other chasad. So the fact is, it's also different. The Gemara tells us that it was in Yerushalayim, there were different groups. Elul Beis Evel, Elul Beis Mishnah. There were groups that took care of Avelus, and there were groups that took care of parties. Why is Avelus first? It's a little out of order. Basically, it's based on the Pasuk in Koheles. Tov L'Lechus L'Beis Evel, L'Lechus L'Beis Mishnah. But it's also another reason. The reason is when you have a Mishnah, when you have a party, you have at least a week for a bris. Okay, Shalom Zachar, maybe not. I know my parents used to live in Matusdorf. They had a Gemach for Arbus. So if someone died right before Shabbos, you just ran down the block or whatever it was, and you got Arbus of beer, and you had, you were ready for the Shalom Zachar. It was a Gemach. That's it. But normally you have time. When it comes to Avelus, it's immediate. It's Erev Shabbos, it's Erev Yontif. It's going to take a tremendous difference. Someone dies Erev Yontif, you bury them Erev Yontif. They're buried. Not bury them Erev Yontif, you have to wait till Chol HaMoed. And then the family has to sit Shiva after Yontif. You're talking about a 2-week difference because of 1 hour, 1 day. So you have to be in place, you have to be ready. Chesed Shel Emes. We know that Chesed Shel Emes is called that. I think I'm going to take a few minutes only because I will tell you that I have found that our work is under attack in our world. There's only now we are exposed to so many things in our world in every facet of life, certainly in every facet that affects Jewish life. There's a lot of out there, and I must tell you, reading your procedures, I was so impressed with how careful Rabbi Yudin and Rebbetzin Yudin were to make sure that shilas are brought back to them. And I can't tell you how important that is. It's not just that the Rav has to be a micromanager. It's because it is so easy to have things created that are incorrect. And it's also covered hameh, so you have an answer. You don't have to start questioning and have a debate in the room. All of that, but there is a mesorah. There is someone that gives you direction, that gives you guidance. Chesed Shel Emes is chesed that is true chesed. And it is chesed that is true for a lot of different reasons. We know Rashi's explanation of chesed shel emes is because you don't get any reward. Now that's true from the Erev Kedisha, you get paid. It's not really, but from that person you will never get repaid. That person will never repay. But it's extremely important to understand there is a difference between chesed. And as I said, I'm going to take a few minutes because it's important to explain these concepts. There's a difference between chesed and racha. We know, and to prove it, we know Klal Yisrael, as the Gemara tells us, we have three traits that are within our DNA. We're one of the rachmanim, we have rachmanis, we're baishanim, we have shame, which is a good thing when used appropriately. And we are gomlei chasadim. So obviously, rachmanis and chesed are two different things because they're two of the three traits. So what is the difference between rachamim and chesed? Rachamim is when someone falls and you want to help them. You see their pain. So you have rachmanis. You feel bad for them. Someone tells you a tale of woe and you commiserate with them. You feel empathetic. That's rachamim. Never forget, a man once knocked on my door. Must have been collecting for someone. One of these Eretz Yisrael going around collecting for a personal matter. He had a letter, but it was a Sunday in the summer. There was nobody around, and he knocked on my door, and I opened it, and the man walked in, and he collapsed. How do I mean physically? He broke down, crying, heaving. So it was not a show. There was no one. He I need help, and no one's helping me. Literally broke down. I gave him a donation, probably 50 times more than I normally do, just because rachmanis. You feel rachmanis. You feel someone else's pain. That's not chesed. Chesed is when, from within, you feel a need to do something. No one is asking for it. It's because you know you can help somebody. You know there's someone, not that needs it in the trachmanis, but you can do a good thing for someone. You can just make them feel good. You can say thank you after they say a drasha. You know, after they give it to our Torah. They're not asking for it. It's not rachmanis. It's chesed. I want to do good. There's no bigger chesed shel emes than doing a tahara on someone that doesn't say, but we don't know what they want. We're doing chesed, they're not asking for anything. As far as they're concerned, you know, funeral homes do direct burial. I hate to say, those are direct cremation. What does it mean? They leave the person wrapped in a sheet and they bury them. Okay? The person isn't asking for anything specific. We are doing this because we want to give to this person. And so that is chesed. And it's truer chesed, as I said, because here the person is not asking for anything. You go into a nursing home, people ask for things. No one's asking. We're doing it, and how are we doing it? Because we know that this is the way to do chesed with this person at this time. I remember Yaakov Kamenetsky, I was fortunate, for a tremendous bracha, that I spent 6 hours with Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky in Florida, I think it was 1983. And I asked him a shaila, and I sat with him for hours discussing hashkafa. And one of the things that he said to me was, chesed shel emes doesn't only mean what Rashi says. It means that the chesed that we do, how do we treat this inanimate person who's not asking for anything? How do we know what is chesed? 60% of Americans believe that chesed is cremation. How do we know what is chesed? It's emes. It's the chesed that is defined by Torah as the chesed that we should do. It's defined by the Ikarei HaMuna, by the fundamental concepts of our faith. All of the, we believe that this person is being prepared for Olam Haba, and that they are going to stand before the Ribono Shel Olam and have to give a din of a cheshbon. And so we dress them like the Kohen Gadol walked into the Kodesh HaKodeshim. Okay? Every minhag, everything that we do is a reflection of our belief of chesed, of our belief of emes, of Torah's emes. The Torah tells us it's objective truth. It hasn't changed. Okay? It wasn't always that way. Years ago, people used to dress people with, the Gemara tells us, fancy clothing and all kinds of things. But since Rabbi Gamliel, this has been the Mesorah. This has been what we do, and every minhag is sacrosanct. Every minhag is for a reason. Rabbi Moshe told this over to me over and, I'm sorry, Rabbi Yankov. Rabbi Moshe told me too. But Rabbi Yankov emphasized it. Rabbi Yankov was known as Emes, the Sefer is Emes Liakov. He was known as the Ish Emes. He told me, he says, this is Emes. And he says, you know, that people try to change things because now we have better things and newer things and different things and another approach. And we're open, we talk about things. This was in the 80s. He said, you have to be careful with the Messiah. And I will only say it because there are a lot of Chevra Kadisha movements out there, okay, that are multi-denominational. And they influence the Chevras Kadisha here. It's unfortunate they've changed the tefillas, they've changed the begadim, they've changed all kinds of things. It's a different focus. The focus is on my spiritual experience, the Matayr's spiritual experience, rather than the needs of the person who died. What is best for them? What is the objective chesed for them? That is the focus. When we come into a Tahara room, the feeling should be, A, number one, we are standing in the presence of a person. And it's not just that they are a body that contain a neshama, they're a tzelem elokim, it's that also. But there is a neshama present in the room. And that neshama, for any of us who don't know what a neshama is, there's an article I put out, The Mortality of the Soul, by Ari Kaplan, who describes it. It's a book by Rabbi Ben Sion Schaefer on this. I don't remember what he calls it. But whatever it is, a neshama is us. It's who we are. When we close our eyes for the last time, our entire consciousness, exactly who we are at that time, with all our experiences, with all our knowledge, with all our strengths, with all our weaknesses, with all our accomplishments, with all our everything, continues to live eternally. That is what a neshama is. Someone, famous story with Noach Weinberg, the founder of Esh HaTorah, was once sitting with a young man, and he said, do you believe that you have a soul? He was a totally secular young man who was trying to get into the yeshiva. And the man thought, this young boy thought for a long time. Finally, he says to Rabbi Weinberg, he says, you know, Rabbi, I think I do have a soul. And Rabbi Weinberg yelled at him, if you ever heard Rabbi Weinberg, he says, you are making a mistake, young man. You don't have a soul. You are a soul. You have a body. The soul is who we are. The neshama is us. It's who we are. The body is a lavush. It's what we use while we're living. And in this room, there is a neshama. A neshama that is in a very difficult time of its existence. It's transitioning from a world in which it lived for years, and now it's in a world of emes. It's in an olam ha-emes. And the neshama is concerned to see that the body, which was its partner throughout life, is going to be taken care of appropriately. with kavod, and so we give them kavod. And there is no bigger chesed than that. Of course, if you look at it from that perspective, it might be rachamim too, but it's chesed. And it's chesed defined not by what we feel is chesed, but what has been handed down from generation to generation as being the procedures of the tahara. And it's true there are differences in different communities, but most of these minhagim, almost all of these minhagim, have very, very solid reasoning behind them, even though we may not understand them. And if this is what we were given as our minhagim, and your shul, the Baruch Hashem, has been here now for decades, as was said, and you have a very fine set of procedures, I looked at them, frankly, I was very impressed. Stick with it. Stick with it. And we'll talk about it, we'll go through a lot of those things, but we try not to change minhagim. I have lectured to many Chevras Kadisha, and over the years there have been mistakes that creep into a Chevra Kadisha. It happens, you know, just by mistake. Okay, for whatever the reasons are. My famous story is the one with the woman, I was in Minneapolis, the early years of the Chevra, of my lecturing. I've been in the first or second lecture that I gave out of town, and I really want to mention the city. But whatever it was, at that time, this goes back almost 40 years ago, the face cover, when I showed the face cover, the women said, that's not a face cover. That's an apron. They were using it as an apron. They were not using it as a face cover. And so I said, yeah, first and foremost, this is a face cover. That's the beged that everybody uses. And there are some covers that also use an apron, like it says in your procedures. So I said, you know, so I was trying to make the point, and I said, you know, in New York, like in New York is, you know, Kurdish Kardashian, I said, in New York, we don't use an apron, we only use a face cover. But that's, so the Rebbetzin, who was the head of the Chevra there as well, raises his hand and says, Rabbi, the reason you don't use an apron in New York is nobody cooks in New York. Okay, that was her line. But the idea is, there are minhagim, and sometimes a mistake creeps in. Why? Because they were exposed to a Chevra Kadisha that had an apron, and they thought this was the apron. They didn't know that much about the face cover, so it crept in. There's stories like this. But by and large, if you have minhagim, stick to those minhagim. I'm going to talk about one. So that's a difference in chesed and rachman. Chesed shel emes is defined by emes, and every minhag is sacrosanct. We can discuss specific minhagim, and I know that I never saw the questions, okay? So I don't know exactly what your questions were. And I'm going to tell you how I'd like to go through tonight. After the introduction, I'll take a couple of questions. Then I'm going to go through the beginning of the Tahara process, which is undressing the body and the rechitza, and then I'll take some more questions. And then probably we'll be ready to take the break. If not, hopefully we'll be, we'll have finished all that by the break. Let's talk about what underlies everything that we do. Everything that we do is defined by a goal, kavanah. It's the thread that links everything. And kavanah hames is a huge subject. I can spend 3 hours tonight just on kavanah hames. I won't. But kavanah hames is, first of all, before the tahara. Before you go to the tahara, you should review things every so often. There was a man I told who was a member of Chevra Kadisha locally in Queens. I had a meeting with him about about fundraising issues for my organization. And he tells me, Rabbi, in my drawer right here, so it's in his office, he says, every time I go to a tahara, I pull out my notes from your shiur 25 years ago and I review them. I can't tell you what it blew me away. But that's kavanah hames. Because that's what it's meant to do. You know, especially in small communities where they have one tahara a month or less, it's important to remind yourself. Zayin Adar very often used to be a time to get together and to have a refresher course every year, just go through with the Rav, whatever it was. Review it. Don't go to a tahara if you don't have the time. Don't have the time. I'm limited to 45 minutes or an hour. It's part of kavanah hames. Now, don't get me wrong. There's going to be Erev Pesach. There's going to be crazy situations, and you have no choice. You do what you can. But always understand that you're going with the understanding that everything else will take second place to the needs of the tahara. That's kavanah hames. dress properly. I don't mean sneeze issues, that too. But be dressed appropriately, so that if you're wearing shoes, that if there's water on the floor, you're not going to worry that you're ruining your shoes, because there's going to be water on the floor. And you don't want to stand like this and not be able to get into a tire because you're wearing something that you're afraid might get dirty, or, you know, my gown might tear, or this is going to go through the ground, whatever it might be. Be dressed appropriately. That's part of Kavod HaMeis. Have the name of the Nifter, the father's name of the Nifter, before you go in so you can say tefillos properly. Sometimes people don't know their name, so we use their English name, or we use Ben Avraham or Ben Sarah, or Basara, if we don't know. But the idea is, know that. A talus. Make sure the talus is there. I don't know if you have problems with the caskets. You use probably just a plain box, but there are Cheres Kadisha with it, and the casket doesn't come until the morning. Do the tar in the morning. To do a tar without a casket, that's not Kavod HaMeis. All of these things, make sure that the funeral homes you use, maybe the Cheres Kadisha, has a set of tachrichim for someone very large. It happens. And people that you know who are not large go into hospitals, go into situations where they get steroids, they're suddenly 100 pounds more than they were. It can be very, very, very large. You need to have a set of tachrichim. That's a double X. Make sure the funeral, or triple X. We have a 5X. We just had a case a few weeks ago. It was over 800 pounds. It happens. I mean, we're a community chevra. We're a larger chevra, a bigger community. We serve a big, you know, big place. But you need to have that. Be prepared in every which way. Supplies. Make sure that you have all the supplies that you need. So here I am, and I missed one of the most important things I need to take with me. I don't know why, but it's not in here. But I will talk about that. But the fact is, be prepared in every way. Beautiful in your procedures. If you have a shiloh, ask the shiloh in advance. That's all part of Kavod HaMeis. We don't talk in the Tahara room. Okay, it means even if you need something, someone's outside the Tahara room and you need them. Don't yell, Jack. You're in the Tahara room, you're in front of a mace, you're in front of a neshama. Just have kavod. What you need to say, say it out loud so that everyone can hear. I'll be talking about some of the things you need to say. Say it, but if there's no need to say something, don't talk unnecessarily. Okay, these are all parts of Kavod HaMeis. Just trying to see if there's anything here. Okay, there is no such thing as quantifying a certain minute. This minute is that important, another minute is less important. I'll tell you a quick story. There was a woman in my home, she was a personal friend. In fact, she taught my wife and I Lamaze before we had our first child. And we were very close to her. She was a nurse. Unfortunately, she was diagnosed at a very young age. She was the head of nurses at a very big hospital in New York. And I went to visit her. And I sat with her quite a while. And we talked about her tahara. And she gave me a list of people. She says, pick from these people. Her request. And she said, Rabbi, have all the confidence that everything will be right, everything will be good. I have one request. You might think I'm crazy. She said, but in my mind, I feel that I will be demeaned if the women clean my nails. I don't expect my nails to be dirty, but I just don't feel comfortable with it. Is that okay? And I was making notes. I made all kinds of notes. She had many requests, not only about Tara, but her family, about things which she has been helpful with. At the end, as I was walking out, I said to her, I'm going to do my very best to do whatever you ask. I said, but I would like you to think about something. You asked me about the nails. I said, I'm just not comfortable changing something that's part of our Tahara procedure, even for you. Do I know what's important about cleaning the nails? And as you said, they may be clean. But if that's the minute of our chevra, I don't want to ask the chevra to be mishan at the minute of the chevra. It'll be clean, we're not going to do much anyway. So, you know, just a very cursory, but I don't feel. I said, think about it, let me know. She called me back 2 days later. She says, Rabbi, I'm over it, it's done, good, do what you got to do. Why am I making tell me the story? Not because to show that I got someone to change their mind, chas v'shalom. It's to make, to me, I just felt uncomfortable walking into a Tahara being Mishana. There is a tremendous emphasis, and I'm going to end with this. I brought it along to read. Listen, because it is so prevalent today. There are groups, there are chats that discuss all these things, how they feel about this minute and how they feel about that minute. Understand them in hugging or in hugging. I mean, hugging are a din. When people ask questions, tell me what's halacha, tell me what's minhag. In the Chevra Kadisha, every minhag is halacha, every minhag is din. What you're minhagim are, that's what you follow, and you follow it unquestionably. But this is from the Zichron Meir, who wrote a Likud. He was malakid. He gathered all kinds of sources, proper sources for Chevra Kadisha, and he writes about this issue. He says, he brings it in the name of the Beis Lechem Yehuda, Ein l'chevra kadisha l'shanos min hagam v'shum b'zoyim shal shar v'esim ha'kodman. The reason is because, why are you different than anyone else? It should be the same. V'shamati, he heard that one time they made a new tahara board, and there was a magefa in the town until they brought back the old tahara board and people stopped dying. We don't know these things. We have no idea the Kabbalah and Yadim involved. In Baruch Hashem, we don't have such stories that I know of. Halavai, we never do. But the point is how important it is not to be Mishana Minhagim. So he says, and he brings from Rav Meisels, I believe that is from the Jewish Sacred Society, which was really probably the most widely used book for Tahara, still used in many communities. It was done in Chicago. Rav Meisels, you quote Rabbi Peretz Steinberg, should live and be well. He's our posek. He's the one who paskens all the shilas that I bring to him. He's still our posek. I took over as the head of the Chevra Kadisha with the Vada Rabbanim of Queens. I realized I'm going to have 50 Rabbanim who are going to tell me what they want for their communities. I said, no way. We have to agree to one posek. That's the one who's going to paskin for me. And Rabbi Steinberg had written the pamphlet for his shul. He was a talmid of Moshe. And most of my own knowledge came from Rav Moshe. So that's who he settled on. So Rav Meisels writes in that same book that was put out, he says, I've asked, my request is out there. For those who lead and founded the Chevra Kadisha, Shalomad Hashem, for the sake of Hashem, Shalom Neshanos Ziz Kolshu, not to change the minutest anything. The Chol HaAlochos HaMinhogim Shemuchad Mufnechem, from those Minhogim and Alochos that are there, and whatever Shaila you have, not to do anything without asking your Rav, whatever he brings. And then he says, brings a Gemara in Sanhedrin, that Hashem buried Moshe Rabbeinu, not to be Meshadim Minhogim. Could take Moshe Rabbeinu right up to Shemayim. Why did he bury him? Eliyahu went to Shemayim. Other people went to Shemayim. Why did he bury him? Not to be Mishanim in Hagim. It's Gemara. It's the day that we celebrate, Zayin Nedar, the day that Hashem buried Moshe Rabbeinu. Why not to be Mishanim in Hagim? Just to understand the power of a minhag. I mean, I could tell you stories. It's not for now, but that's a point that I felt. It's a point that right now I feel very much, because for the last few months, I have sensed more and more and more the effect of what's out there. And today, everything is on the internet, everything is emailed and sent and texted and whatever, articles and things. And it's from who knows from what source. Not everything that's written is correct. We need to recognize the importance of Minhagim and not be Mishana Minhagim. Okay. On the other hand, if there are things that we can improve upon in the Tahara process, there's an Indian of improving on things. We used to have something called the Tikkun of the Month. Be Misaki in something. Now, what is a Tikkun that's not Mishana Minhagim? In every Tahara room, we put in a board where you write the name of the person on the board. First of all, when I write the name of the person on the board, this way no one has to ask, do you know the Hebrew name? It's right up there. Not changing a minute, it's just a nice thing to do so that people know it. They don't have to question. It's also the English name of the person. We especially don't know when people come into a Torah, don't necessarily know the person they're doing the Torah on. You can make a mistake, and that would be terrible. So we have a board, okay? That's a tikkun. And as I go through, I might discuss something and say, this is a tikkun. It doesn't change anything. Makes the process that we have a little bit nicer, a little bit better. That's something, the famous story with the Shagas Aryeh, that in his town there was a minhag that on Zayinat, the Rav wrote a tikkun into the book of the Chevra Kadisha, to the procedures of the Chevra Kadisha. So they asked the Shah Tzarya to write a tikkun. So he wrote that the members of the Chevron Kadisha undertake to follow the Aseres HaDibros, the Ten Commandments. They looked at him like crazy. What? Everybody has to follow the Ten Commandments. What do you mean? See, he said, Halavai. They will follow the Ten Commandments like they followed the Minhagim of the Chevron Kadisha. They'll be perfect. We put it into the Minhagim, they'll follow it with the same dedication. No one would ever dream of changing a minute, but like Sigzo, well, a little something, or whatever. It's a, you know, it gives you a concept of what it was. Okay, so a tikkun is a tikkun. Now, let's begin the process. So you come into the Tahara room, and you are prepared. You have the name, the towels. A Tahara, it's beautiful to see. Tahara should be done closer to the Levaya if possible. I don't know if it's shy of today. Most couples can only get together at night. But if certainly if it's about the Mechasha, it's probably an Indian. It's something to do, especially if you send people to Eretz Yisrael. Do it as close as you can to the shipping to Eretz Yisrael, because it's going to be a long time in any case. The Tachrichim should be clean when the person is buried. And the longer it is between the time of the Tahara and the time of the burial, it could dirty the Tachrichim. So those are the reasons why we try to do it. And it doesn't always happen. We ourselves, tonight, our Chevron Kadisha is going out to the Hamptons, okay, to do a kfur. We can't go out tomorrow morning. We're going out tonight, okay? But wherever you can do it closer. There's an Indian in doing it closer. But you come into the Tahara. I don't know if you have a problem with funeral directors here that do not give you the body. They want it, they prepare it somewhat before they give it to you. You don't have that problem. They give it to you straight from... No, they don't touch the body. Is that correct here? Or you do have a problem with that? Okay, good. So then there's the... What? Okay, Baruch Hashem. Okay. I assume you work with different funeral homes, whatever it is. But that's something that, of course, shouldn't be. Okay? So that, when you come in, you should be as involved and as possible with the person. You should be the one to take them from the refrigerator. That is all covered hames. The neshama is much more comforted by members of its own community taking the body than being handled by people who are not from, who are not shomer Torah mitzvahs, to whom they are just another body. There is an inyan that should be done by people who are members of a Chevron Kadisha, people who are from, people who are shomer Torah mitzvahs, at all possible. Can I ask for a raise of hands? How many people in this room have never done a tahara? Tremendous. Tremendous. So, Baruch Hashem, the Emshah should help. I will tell you that from my experience, a man was just nifter. I remember he took me home on Friday before Shabbos when I was first joining the Chevron Kadisha. I was a teenager. I was very nervous. I said to him, I'm scared, you know, like they asked me to join the Chevron Kadisha in Queens. Should I do this? He says to me, what are you afraid of? Live people you have to be afraid of. Dead people? You have to be afraid of dead people. Dead people don't hurt anybody. He says, they're okay. They're just live people you got to worry about. That was what he said. But the truth is, you have to realize what a tremendous chesed is, what a tremendous fulfillment is. And you want to know something? It changes you. One of the biggest chasadim that you can do with a nifter, think about this, one of the biggest chasadim that you can do with a nifter is to walk out of the Tahara room inspired by life. I have the opportunity to live another day. It's a zechus, tremendous zechus for nifter. Again, I get sidetracked. Let's talk about that. The reason I ask, one of the most complex aspects of what we do in the Tahara room deals with blood. So first of all, no, we're always wearing gloves. Worry, you should also know that there's always going to be people in the room that will be able to show you, will take responsibility. You're not going to be there on your own. You will be in the presence of professionals, and not men professionally, but professionals, people who know what they're doing. And the problem with blood is probably the most complex part of the Tahara process, and that is, what blood do we save and what blood don't we save? This morning I got a call from a very well-known Chevron Kadisha. There was a lot of blood. There were a few, pads full of blood. Should we save it? It's too much blood. Of course you save it. But the question is which blood? So blood comes in three categories. One category is blood that flows after death. Someone dies. I'm sorry, blood that flows before death. Someone goes into a hospital and in the process of the admission. They take some blood and they put a little band-aid on the hand. Now they come into the tarim a few days later because of some complication. They die. Now there's still a band-aid on the hand. Technically, that band-aid does not have to be saved. Because there's blood before that. We don't go through life saving any tissue that we used in we had a nosebleed. We don't save blood. Okay? However, in the Tahara room, I think the general procedure is that if you find anything with dam on it, you save it. And the reason is because we don't always know. We don't always know. I remember we used to have sometimes we would get a body with a sheet, and the sheet had blood on it, but the body didn't have blood on it. So probably not his blood, it was from 2 days ago. They did a test or whatever it was. Now it's not his blood. We don't have to say this. We would cut it out. And then the first time I went to the hospital, literally the first time I went to the hospital to pick up a body, it was the husband of someone in the chevra, and we took out a tube from the arm, from the elbow, and as we took it out, the blood squirted to the foot of the bed. And I said to myself, that's blood we would have thrown away. So why should we throw it away? What's so terrible if you put a person's blood from before death with their blood and save it? So that's something just as a practice. But you should know that blood before death does not have to be saved. But on the other extreme, blood that flows at the time of death, even before the death, which contributed to the death itself, which, for example, is in an accident, a person loses a lot of blood. And then eventually they go into shock, and eventually they die. All of that blood is considered dam nefesh, blood through which the soul may have departed, and that blood must be saved under all conditions. And there's a difference in halacha, and that's why I'm explaining it to you. So if it's dam nefesh, we are very, very careful to say we go to zaka, you see it all over the place, but zaka, it's not only blood, sometimes it's tissue, it's more than that. And I remember as a child growing up in Williamsburg, there was a man who was killed by a tenant who stabbed him to death to want to pay his rent. And the guy died right on the street. And the Chevra Kadisha dug a hole so that all of his blood that seeped into the earth would be buried in his cavern. And as children, we gathered around this spot to see what this was all about. This was where he died. But that's to that extent, even though it's dirt. But you bury it with the person. Blood is to be buried under all circumstances. You have to break up a sidewalk if you have to. You do what you have to do to make sure that blood that is part of an accident, or part of a person's death scene, needs to be buried. It doesn't always have to be an accident. We've had a number of cases of people who died from a varicose vein that opened and bled and bled and bled. Because the person lived alone, or in one case, because it just bled so quickly that they didn't have a chance to stop, the person died. Well, that blood has to be saved. So that is dam nefesh. The blood that we deal with under most circumstances is blood that flows after death. And there's a difference among poskim whether we have to do it. So you might hear from a Chevra Kadisha that we don't save that blood. Maybe you don't. I will tell you that in the United States of America, almost all chevras do save dam that flows after death. I believe that the Hasidus should certainly do. They're even more modern than the Litvishim do. I remember Rabbi Yaakov in that conversation I had telling me, a mensch's blood is nicht billig. A person's blood is not cheap. A person's blood, we don't just discard. A person's blood is covered. We don't discard a person's blood. So a person bleeds after death. We remove a tube and it's bleeding, we save it. The goal, and that's not for tonight's shir, but the goal in the process is to remove the tube without the bleeding, to stop the bleeding and not allow it to bleed, and then be able to bury the blood that's there, and to also have them buried without any kind of contraptions attached. So that is the goal. But certainly blood is saved. The difference between dam nefesh and not dam nefesh is as follows. Everyone who holds that we save blood after death agrees that if that blood is mixed with dirt, let's say it's mixed with, fecal matter, or sometimes with urine, body fluids, whatever it might be, you don't save it. Unless it's Reuben, it's blood, it's really blood, there's a little bit of something in it that you can't separate, okay. But basically we don't. But if it's dam nefesh, then much more, we should be much, much more careful not to throw away the blood. We wrap it, even if it's mixed with dirt, we put it at the foot of the urn. And in some instances, the real halach is, if someone was a horror, someone was killed, especially if they were killed by a guy, we didn't touch the body altogether. We basically left it exactly as it was. We would just lay out the tachrichim on top. We could, even if we could have removed the clothing and done it to tahara, we didn't do it. We left it that way, so that when they came to Shemayim, our belief is one of the riyas to that, that when people come to Shemayim, they look the way they looked. They look in the kever, which is why tachrichim should be clean. Because people appear before the Ribbono Shel, before the Kisei HaKavod, in their clothing that they're wearing as they are. You know, today we know, you see a screen, you get a shot, you get it on our phones, we get pictures. Now, years ago, people had to imagine such a scene that, you know, a person could appear in front of the Kisei HaKavod like they are on the camera. Today, you know, we don't have to, we're like the Chofetz Chaim said, we're such a small door, we need all these aids, these visual aids to help us understand these, you know, subtle concepts. But the idea is that that's what we believe. So therefore, we put them, we left them as they were, so they would be Ma'or Rachmim. So Ribbono Shel Olam would see what it is for us to live in this Golus, us, our children, live in this Golus. You were killed. People die in such horrible ways. We leave them there. Just, well, I believe that's what we do. Ada Yom Hazeh. They're left. Okay, here, usually it's different. Because here, you should know that Chas V'Shalom, somebody dies in an accident, in some kind of a homicide, or any kind of a violent death, they go to the medical examiner's office. And even if we can stop the autopsy, we're still going to have it undressed. It's not going to have that same scene that we say, you will be more rachamim, and therefore we do whatever we can do. It changes the halacha. But that is important for Dam, for you to understand, so you'll understand, those of you who have not been that familiar, to understand that those who are familiar, to get certain guidelines, that is the goal. So the goal is A, to stop the source of bleeding, and remove any tubes so that it doesn't continue to bleed after that. And whatever you remove, if it's clean, if it's not mixed with dirt, you put it away. If you have a pad that has dirt on it and blood on it, you can cut away the dirt and a little dammit with it, you throw it away. The rest of it you can bury. That is the minhag in most of the United States. Eretz Yisrael, they're much less makbid on blood. But that doesn't mean it's different minhagim, different halachas, different poskim. They follow different things. It's only yes, it was very makel. There are others that were makel, but that is the minhag that we follow, and we follow it very carefully. I talk too much, it's late. I'll take a couple of questions if anybody wants. We touched on minhagim, so if you want to go into that, whatever you want, I'll take a few minutes if there are other questions. If not, well, yeah.
What about in a car accident with blood all over, you don't know
what
the blood is
on? You do your best to clean up as best as you can, and the Cheres Kadesh, I'll tell you an unbelievable story. Again, I don't want to spend too much time, but a phenomenal story. I got a call from a Rav in California. He had a son living here, and his son called him very upset. He said, "You remember my friend died last year, that horrible accident?" He said, he just came to me in a dream. And he said to me, "Why don't you bury me?" So I know what to do. Next night, same dream. "Why aren't you burying me?" So he called his father, who was a rov. He said, "What do I do?" His father called me. "So what do I do?" "I don't know. What do you think?" I said, "Find out where the car is. Find out where the car is." If it made any sense to me. I'm not a Navi, I'm not a Malach, but your question made sense. Believe it or not, that car had just been released a few days earlier by the district attorney, or the, whatever it was, the sheriff's office out in, I think it was Nevada somewhere, and it was due to be crushed the next day. Now, they crush these cars. They're like, I don't know how big, they're tiny. They crush it to nothing. So I told the Rav, so he did the research, he called the office, they tell him to be crushed, he says, "Please put a hold on it. We're going to send people in." They sent members of Satsol or Misaskim, one of these organizations, about 10, probably Misaskim wasn't there, members of Chevron Venetian to go out there, and they found in the car, not only the seats were saturated with blood, there was actually bone, there was actually parts of the, you know, there was parts that had never been taken. They didn't need it for their investigation. And that's where it was. So they cleaned it and they buried it in this kever, and that was it.
So he must have, for some reason, he had his chus to be able to get this message across that he wanted this buried in his kever. For whatever reason, do I know what he did in his life to have this chus? Yes?
You mentioned the blood when it's dirty, it could be with excrement. How do you, it's important to bury the blood, you don't bury it together.
So right, so I'm saying we cut out normally when we're dealing with things that we have 99.9% of the time, just cut away as much as you can, that's real blood. There's a little blood left that's connected, but you can't throw it away. There are enough Muslims that say, throw it down on a reason. But if you have it in the case like where a person dies in an accident, even if there's dirt, we generally take everything and bury everything. Okay, it's different. Okay, now, so let's move on. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I just had a question. If you don't mind just clarifying again, so when does the body get left that they appear before God as they were when they die versus they have to
I'm sorry. When a person dies, and they, when you put them in the keter, that's when they appear before the kisei hakavod, and that's when and they appear as they do in the keter. Okay.
And there's not a case that they just put a sheet on top of the person.
There are times, I'm saying, there are times where you can't do anything, like the person is, that's how they appear. That's how they appear, exactly as they are. That's the difference. But they appear before the keys that covered exactly that. There's something, I think somebody just showed me, a reason to rush kvura, is that until a person appears before the keys that covered, sometimes a person has to have a gil, be reincarnated. And if you can't, if they don't get buried, that process can't begin. And they say sometimes there's a good gilgul that the Rebbe Shlomo is saving for them. And by not burying them as immediately as you can, they lose that opportunity. They'll get a worse gilgul. Think about the people who are cremated, they may never have the zechus of gilgul. It's a zechus, a gilgul has, right? It's not exactly what it means that the person comes back and the person's not in Olam Haba. It means a certain part of that person comes back. Whatever. Again, not for tonight's discussion. Read the afterlife, you'll get a better understanding. Whatever it might be, the idea is, it's a big picture. There are so many things that are involved. Maybe I'm going to throw it in now, Yosef, and I hope you'll forgive me. I really, really, really do. Well, we were discussing the Indian of using egg and vinegar, whether it should be continued or not be continued. And, you know, it's one of those things, there are many chevers that don't, and the chever is starting, maybe it's something to consider, reconsider. And it just struck me, literally struck me, last night I was thinking about the shear, and it came back to me, and I said to myself, what's the reason for this egg and vinegar? The reason for the egg and vinegar is because it used to be that they used to take out bodies at customs houses when they were going from town to town, and they would put in a dead guy, and they would bury it in the Jewish cemetery. What they did with the body, God only knows, but they would put a guy into the keter. And then there would be you would cry that some guy died, and then a whole city could be wiped out because they killed a guy. This was how pogroms happened. So in those parts of Europe where this was prevalent, the Chevra Kedisha came up with an idea that when they would get the body back, they wouldn't have to completely unwrap the body to see who it was, which we don't want to do, but they would be able to check by smell, which is very strange, by egg white, which is very sticky, they would be able to tell right away if this is their body or not. If they didn't feel that, they would say, this is no body, you must have given us the wrong one, and they would insist on getting their body back. That's how it happened. But think about it. So why did we continue this when the pogroms stopped? Because this became part of the identity of a Jew that came up to Shemayim. We're living in a Golos where this is what's going on. Think of what's going on today. This anti-Semitism. This is what's going on in Israel. This is Mor Rachamim. So why do we want to take that away? This is, I believe, the reason we continue. This is because it's that Golus. It's that same concept. It's that concept of appearing before God and having the Ribbono Shel Olam have Rachmanis on this Golus. That's how I understand it. I may be wrong, but that's how I understand it. If it is, it makes so much sense.
Question on that?
Sure.
So my understanding is that when Rama discusses that how it was done, there's people say back that Rama says that we do it in order to be a kavod to mace because the mace's body smells and therefore it's a kavod. So even there were people that were being killed beforehand before the Rama, people weren't, and this is how Allah was. So we're just reverting back to the original Allah. So
I understand, but the Rambam was before this time, and the Rambam's not the Gemara talks about the Mizalef B'yayin. It goes before the Rambam. The fact is that, yeah, years ago, the big problem was the odor. There was no refrigeration, so we used to put up a supplement. That was the reason why we did it at that time. But once we went through a historic period where the identity of a Jew became such that we wanted to be Ma'or and Shemayim, the fact that Jews are dying on a daily basis, and they died there, but this became a way of expressing that, and a way of having that in Shemayim, that vision, that was continued, because that became the new, it wasn't because of the smell, it had nothing to do with the smell, it was a whole new concept, which started at that time, and I guess the Kehillos, the Rabbanim at that time, even went once the pogroms stopped, they felt it was kedai to continue it, so they continued it. And it makes a lot of sense, again, because we're still in the goal. So what happened after that? We had a Shoah, we had, you know, we had the Bacha, who knows? And look at today. You can't walk in the street without looking behind you. Okay, so it's there. So this is part of what we do to be more rachim. That's how I see it. Again, chas v'sholom, I'm not questioning anything. I'm not lobosi rak l'or. I'm here not to tell anyone what to do, just to tell you to stick to the minhagim that you have. That's all. That's what I say, because that's what's brought out. Yes. Last question.
You had mentioned earlier, if I understood correctly, that in Israel, somehow maybe it does look slightly different than it is here. So if someone passes away here and is buried in Israel, what happens?
It's a very good question, actually, because this comes up with, for example, putting on a talus. They're going to take off the talus in Israel. They don't bury the talus. Although in Israel, they come to the kever with the talus. So why we don't send it from here, I don't know. Rav Moshe answered this question for me. And Rav Moshe told me, it even comes up in, I noticed it in your procedures, not to put on a for Eretz Yisrael. Rav Moshe said, if you put on a for Eretz Yisrael, you should continue putting on a for Eretz Yisrael. That's what he told me. Why? He says, you do your minhagim. It'll come there. They don't like it, fine. But the niftar, our minhag is everybody gets a for Eretz Yisrael. Put on, you put on a for Eretz Yisrael. We put on a for Eretz Yisrael. So what happens? So we put in a little more offer. So what? Okay, it's not a terrible thing to have a for Eretz Yisrael in the camera. So I'm just saying, but that was his answer to that question. We do what we can. On the other hand, we do certain things in the Aron to make sure that there's very little possibility of the body purging on the way to Eretz Yisrael and during the Tachrichim. So we will, for example, always pack rectally, because it could happen over such a long period of time there could be leakage that will dirty the Tachrichim. So maybe in that case we would normally not pack, but when we're going to Eretz Yisrael, we always pack rectally. Okay? That's one example. We will always raise the head. It's one of the reasons I asked for an art. We always raise the head, because when you raise the head on the pillow and you put the head, and that should always be, but particularly when you're shipping, going to Eretz Yisrael, when you raise the head, you're closing the airway. If you ever took a first aid course, I was told the story, I had a terrible fear when I took over the Chevra Kadisha. My fear was that I was going to be doing the Tahara and someone's going to start coughing on the Tahara table. Something that we tried to catch their breath. I know how to deal with dead people. I have the vaguest idea of how to deal with. Like, you hear stories, people come back, you know, whatever it is. There are things that mimic death. There happen such stories. Baruch Hashem never happened to me, but I had this terrible fear. I'm not going to be doing this for years and years, thousands and thousands. It could happen. I was afraid. So I took a course with Hatzalah. I will tell you, it was the best thing I ever did. It was by Sharon that I had this fear. Absolutely, min hashamayim. Why? Because I learned a lot of things about the body that helped me know how to do a tahara. And one of the things I learned was that when you bring the head back, you're opening the airway and you're bringing up fluids. People hold the head and it goes down and they lift it up again and it goes down and they lift it up again. You're pumping up fluids, which very often are in the chest. So you don't want to do that. You want to keep the head steady. But you want them, when the person is in the aro, that the head is up and it's solidly placed on the pillow and the pillow is raised. It's brought down halacha. Even if a person dies right away, you put something under the head to raise the head. We are meant to close the airway so that it doesn't come up. So in an aron going to Eretz Yisrael, we will take straw, the straw that's in the aron, and we place it under the head to make sure we put a pillow under it so that the head is raised solidly on inside the pouch and it gets to Eretz Yisrael. It's clean. I can't tell you how many people told me when they got to Eretz Yisrael. By the way, I have almost no connection with the Chavrusha in Eretz Yisrael. I was there a few times. I tried going to the towers. It never worked out. For whatever reason, it must have been my share that it shouldn't work out. I think I was better off. They were better off. It was good. It wouldn't have been a good ship. But the fact was that they know that when the body comes from the Vat of Queens, it's clean. And it's because of this. It's the only reason. It's because we raise the head and we take precaution to make sure that it doesn't purge. So that's something that we do differently. Not that it's different, it's just, it's a tikkun. It's something we always do, but we're careful that it should be raised so that it does not dirty the tachlit. Will it definitely not? Maybe it will, but chances are it will not. Okay, so that's...
You tie the head.
We always try to close the mouth. Yeah, I mean, if something, you'll have cases, we can talk about it, it's not what we're talking about right now, but you have cases where there's purging because there's just pressure from within. A person can be very heavy, whatever it is, and there's a lot of pressure. In those cases, if we send Eretz Yisrael, we'll actually pack the mouth, okay, before we do so, okay? But that's very unusual, okay? And in a normal situation, even if you have that, if you raise the head properly, usually you don't. But sometimes we do, even in this situation, even if it's going to just the kettle, because otherwise you know that it's going to dirty the tachrichim. So that is something that you are careful about. Okay. You come into the... So we're moving on. You come into the tahara room, and you wash your hands. Right, left, right, left, right, left. One thing I will say that I'm going to say different than what's in the procedures, we do not have to dry our hands. We do not have to leave our hands to air dry when we do a tahara. Because the reason why we air dry our hands after a levaya is because we don't want to walk away from the levaya. We're done, finished, wash your hands, literally wash your hands in the affair. I'm going home, on with life. You want it to linger. You want that, we talked about that hisorus. I just was in the presence of death. My life needs to be a little different. Okay? That, to take that with you, you don't just want to dry your hands. But when you're in a tahara, and you're doing the tahara, and you're washing your hands, it's going to just take a lot of extra time. You're not walking away, you could dry your hands. I discussed this with Poskim because I heard the same thing when I started doing tahara. So we did, especially when we started putting on gloves, in the late 80s when AIDS became an issue, we started putting on gloves. We used to never put on gloves. Ramesha told me, don't put on gloves. It's a bizarre to do a tahara with gloves, okay? In those days, we weren't that careful. Nobody wore gloves. I did thousands and thousands of taharas without gloves. But once AIDS came along, we did. I remember the big article in one of the Jewish, the Yiddish newspapers, okay? There was an article about Aaron Soloveitchik had kipaskin mekton tahara methedjikis. You could do a tahara with gloves. Okay, that was it was on the front page of one of the Jewish papers. But in any case, the fact is that we used to not do that, but you don't have to let it dry. It's something that you can just dry your hands with regular paper towels and then put on gloves, no problem. That's before when you come in and also before the tahara. When you leave, you will not dry your hands. When you leave, you wash your hands. After a tahara, you don't dry your hands. So that's something I would suggest that you could change, okay? Now, there is... So you come in. Now, I'm going to make a radical suggestion. I don't really know what your funeral homes look like. But if you come in and there are four people there, and there's someone filling buckets, and there's someone doing other things, you can prepare the urn at that time. It will save time, okay? And it also, you could prepare it. It also gives you an opportunity sometimes to see that the tachrichim you have may not be big enough for the person. The aron may not be big enough for the person. Rather than you're ready for the aron, and now you just got to do it. The only thing is you got to be careful that you put, I lay out the tachrichim in the aron, okay? We'll talk about it very quickly. You lay out the aron, you put out the soveh first. And again, I noticed that the soveh that you're using is a soveh that you have to put in diagonally. Right? Years ago, they used those sovevs all across the country because they were saving on a little material. It was cheaper. Nowadays, almost everyone uses a full sovev, which actually covers the entire arum. No, it's a composite, it's a rectangular. Sovev is the sheet that you put into the casket. It's a rectangle, and it's misabe, it's kol aguf. It's the way it's meant to be. So I don't know what you're getting or not getting, but I would make sure that all the funeral homes you're using, use that. The place they're getting it from is Rose Solomon. Rose Solomon sells them. It's maybe a dollar more expensive, or the linen maybe $5 more, whatever it is. But it has an extra material, and you can wrap the body appropriately, and that's what I would do. Okay? So that's just as it. But you put in the sobev, then for the men, you put in the talus, set up the art, make the pillow. And I'll show you before I go, one of the things I asked for an art is really to show you this, to how to use the excelsior, that wood shaving, so that you can have the pillow laying properly under the head so that it holds the head in place, so that the head doesn't fall to the side, it doesn't fall down, and it's not lying back, it's raised properly. You need to, that's something that is just a way of, it's a tikkun that I think is a tremendous tikkun, has tremendous ramifications, and I discussed this again, poskim or maskim 100%, there's a pillow, there's a reason for the pillow, so the pillow should be under the head to raise the head, like a pillow was meant to raise the head. Okay, that is something that I will show you later. But again, the sheet should preferably be a silver. They call it the Vad set, named for the Vad, named for me, the Vad of Queens. I insisted on having it years ago, and it's used really a lot of places across the country now. Certainly in all the from places in New York they use it. That's something I would suggest. Now, you come in, you wash your hands, you fill up buckets. This is a 5-gallon painter's bucket, which is perfect. It doesn't have a lip, which is good. It doesn't have a spout, which is better. I would recommend that for the tahara, you use 3-gallon rather than 5-gallon because you don't have to, it's not that heavy. If you use 3-gallon buckets, it's enough to fill 8 quarts of water, which is only 2 gallons, and enough for some extra, and it's easier to work with. So I would suggest using 3-gallon buckets. You could use it for the rechitza water also, whatever you want, but rather than 5-gallon, which are very heavy, especially if you fill them all the way up to the top. When you're doing the rechitza, it makes no difference. The rechitza is the washing. When you're preparing for the washing, it makes absolutely no difference how many buckets you fill. You could fill 10 buckets, it doesn't matter, for the rechitza, how many buckets you're going to fill. It should be lukewarm water, which I saw is in your procedures, and that is with which you will wash the person. So while someone is preparing buckets, someone else could be preparing the aron, and then you bring the person in. You bring them in feet first, place them on a table. Here's a kavod habeis issue. Always have the head of the person higher than the rest of the body. This table is a table I would never consider using for a tahara. Obviously, it has no grooves on the sides, it doesn't have a hole on the bottom, it's missing other things. Tables you should be able to be lifted so that the head is always higher than the rest of the body. Not only for the tahara, for the rechitza. A body should never be left flying flat because what happens is it fills the mouth with water and therefore with fluids. That's usually what happens when a person dies. Fluids form in the lungs and they come into the chest. If the head is higher, even if the table is higher, gravity does its job. It stays where it should stay. So that's something you should always have. You're taking a body from the tahara table to the mikveh. The board, whatever it is you're moving it on, should always be higher at the head. It should never go feet higher, for sure, but the head should always be higher throughout the process. It's just something that makes it more likely to keep the tachrichim clean and to be able to mix it easier for everyone, because it's much less problem, there's much less chance of complications through things purging from the mouth. Okay? So that is something to keep in mind. Okay, now you come in, and you place the body on the table, and you undress it. Bodies usually come in pouches, or they come wrapped in a sheet, or in a hospital sheet. Sometimes they're wearing a hospital gown, sometimes they're wearing clothing, sometimes they're undressed, whatever it might be. They come in all these ways. First of all, you always make sure that the body is properly dressed. I assume the funeral home is
careful to always make sure it's covered, and you bring it into, put it on the Torah table, the head is raised, and now you are ready to start. I don't know how many people you have. I saw in your procedures, I was astounded that you have 5 people as a regular, and 7 or 8 if possible. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. I fight for 4 in most chevras, and for 3 years ago, the battle was 3. They were doing it with 2. I don't know how to do a Torah with 2 people. I couldn't tell you how. I don't know. Okay? But with 3, with the Evid, you can make do. But 4 is lachatchila. That's what you should do. It should be 4 at least. 5 is nachbes, especially you have the gabbai doesn't get involved. By the way, we call the gabbai the Rosh. And part of Kavod Hames is that every Tahara has a Rosh, has a person in charge. There's a Rosh or a gabbai, call it whatever you want. And that gabbai is in charge. No one questions in our chevra. We can have 4 women going out or 4 men going out, all of whom are roshot or roshim, roshay, whatever they are. They're all. But at that tahara, we designate this person. That person makes the decisions. That person can turn to others and say, "What do you say?" But if they make a decision, that decision stands. You have a question, you can ask later. That's it. You can ask the Rosh, would you mind? We don't do that. The Rosh is the Rosh. That's part of the Kavod Hames. There should be no machlokas, there should be no discussion in the Tahara about what to do, what not to do. That's something that should be either checked before or at the time the person in charge. There is a Seder HaTahara, but before we get to that, let's talk about the Mace. The body's on the table. You have to undress it. Okay, so okay, now some chevras keep the face covered, some chevras don't. You do. Okay, beautiful. We don't. Some chevras do, some chevras don't. Whatever your minhag is, it's pure. I personally, it always bothered me that we don't, but we don't. That's our minhag, and we didn't change it. We have enough hardships in our chevra kedisha. We cover a lot of things. One thing less hard, that was our minhag, we kept it that way. Everyone agrees. Thanks. Everyone agrees that the body should be covered, whether it's the entire body. Most chevras, at least the women, will cover from the shoulder to the knees. Or cover the whole body. For the men, at least the private areas are covered. Everybody. No shilas about that. That's everybody. So you make sure that as you address the person, everything remains covered as it should be immediately. If you address the person, if it's possible to address them without having to cut it, then you try to save it, especially if they're wearing clothing that maybe could be used somewhere else. Body dies in clothes. The clothes could be used. The only thing we don't use are shoes. But other than that, and even shoes that are not on the body is also meant to be used. It's only the shoes that a person dies in. But other shoes could be used. But the point is, you never know. Family may want the suit back for whatever reason. Someone may want to use it, whatever. If you don't have to cut it. But if you have to cut it, you cut it on the right side. Because you're going to turn the body on its left, exposing the right, and then you'll roll under whatever is there, and you'll turn the other way and take it out. So that is the way that generally we do it. Now, when you're undressing the body, whether it's from a hospital, whether it's a house, whatever it might be, there is another part to the Tahara process, which in my opinion is the most complex part of the process, it can be anyway. It's not something you're going to find in the Sfarim. The Tahara process is the rechitza, the washing, the Tahara, the pouring of the purification waters and putting in the mikveh, and then the halbasha, the dressing. That's the parts of the Tahara, and that includes putting it in the Arun. But there's a first part called the survey. I learned that in that Hatzolah shiur that I took. When a person comes on the scene of an accident, they do a survey. They check the body. Famous person who died in, Rosenbaum, died in Crown Heights, unfortunately died because on the sheet from Hatzolah it said that he had a puncture in his back, but in the hospital they neglected to do anything about it. They missed it. And he was bleeding while he was on the gurney, and he bled to death. By the time they caught it, he was in shock. They couldn't bring him back. Okay? So a survey is important. Someone could be shouting at the scene of an accident, "My ear, my ear." They could have an ear that's lacerated, that's torn, that's terribly painful. But the reason they're screaming their ear is because they have no feeling below their neck. They could be in a very difficult situation with tremendous problems lower down, but you're not going to know about it. So you have to survey the body and see what's going on. Are there other issues? Is there bleeding elsewhere? Is there punctures that maybe they don't feel? You have to go through the body and survey it. The same thing is true when you're doing a tahara. As you undress the body, notice not only tubes and things that may have to be removed or that the mouth is purging, whatever it is, but you're going to notice on the hand there's a puncture right here. A little puncture. There's a little scab on top. Now, if you don't bother it, it won't bother you. But if you don't make note of it, if you don't survey it, as you're washing the body, you're going to pull off the scab and it's going to bleed. Or as you're dressing it, or as you're turning the body, or whatever you do, you're going to press on it, it'll bleed. So you want to make sure that everybody knows that there's a... Now you have to talk, and talk loud enough for everyone. We have a tikkun. Let me give you a perfect example of a tikkun they have that I'm so proud of. I love this tikkun. The person who washes the right side of the body also dries the right side of the body and also dresses the right side of the body. And you know why? And same on the left. You know why? Because they know what's going on. They've already seen what's there and they've already dealt with it. So rather than have someone else come in who may not be as clear, sometimes there's very sensitive skin on the inner arm. And if you turn the body, pulling the arm, which I'm going to show you we shouldn't do, but let's say we do that, or you're just washing vigorously, you'll tear the skin. The person on the right notices that, and you should again say it. Or will everyone remember that? But that person is already doing it. They'll remember when they're careful, when they wash, when they dry, and when they dry, and when they dress, it will be the same thing. But those are things. Sometimes, I'll give you another example. Sometimes on the heel, you will find a blister. It's a bed sore, really, on the heel. Right over here on the heel, there's like a... The skin of the heel is very thick. And underneath it, there's like a blister of blood. It's closed, not a problem. But the problem is that the person washing on the side, right here on the right side, really can't see it because it's on the bottom here. They don't always see it. So if they're washing, especially if the feet are a little dirty, they can tear it very easily and now it's bleeding. Make a note, there's a blister on the right heel so the people on that side can see it, let them know, so on and so forth. Those are the things you should do. So in the process of the survey, is where you need to know all the ways to deal with complexities, to spot what's complex, how to remove tape, that's when you do it. Even one thing we do, we generally don't do anything except in the order of the washing, except for here. To prepare the body for the rechitza is all done in the survey. You're going to remove the bandages, you're going to remove the tubes, the intravenal tubes, the Foley catheter, all of that is going to be done in the process of the survey. So that when you start the tahara just goes. Okay? And also the nail polish for women or men. We have nail polish for men today. Men, nail polish. I will tell you a psak that I've gotten recently. For many years we struggled with nail polish. Now that nail polish has gotten so good, you can't take it off. Many poskim have told me to leave it, including Rav Shmuel First and Rav Peretz Steinberg and others, just leave it. So we are now leaving it. Again, if you have regular nail polish, remove it. But where you have gel, where it's just very well done, a person decides to have gel, they have to know that they may have to appear before the Kisei HaKavod that way. Yeah, we don't think of it that way. That's for sure, but I'm just... No, I'm just... What, you're talking about the nail polish. Because generally, I'm saying, if it's to that extent, it's bottle. I will say something else. People need to realize also, the chatzitza that we have by tahara is not the same chatzitza that applies to mikveh. Mikveh is a doraisa, it's a kriyat natora, and therefore chatzitza is a mashal. This is a drabbanon, okay? And therefore, drabbanon, for it to be a chatzitz, it has to be most of the body, and you have to be makbid, okay? So if you have to use blue pads or something to cover it there, if there's a leg that is in very bad, it's gangrenated, okay? And you want to be able to pour water, but you know you're going to lose blood if you do that. You could take a blue pad, a chuck, and put it on and tie it and do a tahara right over it, because he's not makbid, adarabi, he wants the tahara, or she wants the tahara. So that's not a problem. So in the survey, you prepare the body for the washing, okay, for the rechitza.
Okay, that's where it's very important to survey and to talk and to do what has to be done. There is a preference for the right over the left. So whenever we do, as we undress, we look at the right side, we undress from the right side, then the left side. We turn the body onto its left, exposing the back of the right, and then we put the body, the bodies on the table, completely undressed, covered. All the problems have been taken care of, or they've been left, whatever your decisions are. But that is the survey, and that is the first part of the tahara process. There's a tefillah that is generally said when we come into the tahara once the body is on the table, and that is the tefillah as we're about to start. The tefillah of Ribono Shel Olam Chamol, yes, the Ribono Shel Olam Tav Rachmanus on the person to forgive them, and so on. That is the beginning of the rachitza. Now, I'm going to run through the rachitza very, very quickly, and then we'll take a break. The rachitza is a washing that is meant to wash the body. It is not just some kind of routine rinsing. It's brought down like a person washes themselves before Shabbos and Yontif. That's how you wash the body. Therefore, there are certain things. There are times people lie in the hospital sometimes for a very long time. People are older. They don't shower for a long time. It's hard for them. They can be very dirty. You have to wash them. You have to clean them. Okay? Sometimes we generally do not use soap, but if there's a need for it, you use soap. The only thing you have to be careful is that we are creatures of habit. And habit doesn't form after long periods of time. Habit is very quick. You do something once, you do it twice. Next time you're going to do it, you're going to be using soap. So if you have two cases in a row where you need to use soap, third case, let's use soap. It's there. It becomes habitual. So you have to remember that the minute is not to use soap. We use it when we need it, and that's our meaning. There are chevers that use soap, and Eretz Yisrael. Here again, what's the difference between us and Eretz Yisrael? They use soap routinely, we don't. Okay, now, but there are things you have to wash. Sometimes people have creams that they put on. Their skin is dry. They'll put on Vaseline, they'll put on something like that. That should be washed, it should be cleaned. You're using lukewarm water, it works. Soap might be a good thing to use in such a case because it just takes it off much more easily. There are certain creams that soap is the only way to do it, so you need to use it. But generally, we don't. There is a Seder HaTahara, and the Tahara begins with the head. Now, the way Tahara was set up is... you have one person watching and one person pouring. You have one person washing and one person pouring. So the person who's washing will hold the cloth. The person that is washing generally stands closer to the feet. And the person pouring stands closer to the head and pours for the person washing. So when we come to the head, for example, you would start with the right side. Person pouring would pour for the person washing. Now, on the head, there are many chevers that do not pour water directly onto the face because it'll fill the mouth and the nose with water. If you do, then maybe just on the forehead, cover the mouth and the nose while you're doing it so it will not go in. But many chevers, just for the face, will have the person pouring pour directly onto the cloth so that the person washing can wash. Okay? Now, the minhag is... they bring a pot, might be in there. It's one of the things I actually asked for. Right? Then bring for a pot. Okay. Fine. Okay. So we generally fill that bucket with lukewarm water, and we take either a quart pot. We like to use a saucepan, a 2-quart saucepan, which fills a lot of water, and it, again, has no spout. And that's what we use. We find it's easier. It's a longer handle, whatever it is. You dip it in, and you then pour. Now, the minhag is for the person who's pouring to pour backhand for the person washing. It's brought down. This is why people don't open soda and pour soda backhand for other people, because that's how the Chevra Kadisha pours. I don't know if you ever heard that. But no one knows why. The Zichron Meir says he doesn't know a reason. I have a reason. I don't know if it's true, but it makes a lot of sense. It reinforces the way we do it. Think about it. You're standing over here and you're washing the hand,
right? You're washing the shoulder, you're washing the knee. I'm washing. The person who's pouring is standing over here in front of me, pouring for me. Now, if there, imagine you have a saucepan or you have a quart that you wash your hands with until you die, right? So now, if you're pouring forehand, which means you're pouring like this, right? That's, if a person's a righty, he's pouring like this. I, who am standing here, what do I see? I don't see the water. I see the back of the pot. Because again, if the person standing here is pouring forehand, then what I'm looking at is why I needed that pot so I could see it. Okay? You will see the back of the pan. The back of the, you can't see the water flowing. The only way you can see the water that you're washing with is if you pour it this way. Then you have full sight of what you're doing and you're able to wash it appropriately. So they had to pour that way. It just reinforces the way we do it. Someone poured and someone washed. The person pouring stood here, the person washing stood here. And the person washing here a few times yelled, "Will you stop pouring like that? Of course I can see." So after a few times, that became the minhag for the Chevra Kadisha. Since it's the minhag of the Chevra Kadisha, you don't do it. That's all. It's no big deal. It's no big lumpness. It's not a big Kabbalah in your practicality. It's just practical. That's our belief. I've told it over to many people. They loved it. It makes sense. It just makes sense. Okay? That's it. But you do pour backwards because that's not because of any special heebie-jeebie reason, simply because it's practical. So the person, we start with the head. Person on the right washes the right side. Person on the left washes the left side. The right side always starts first and then followed by the left. We do the entire head before we do the rest of the body. Okay, we are careful. In the corner of the eyes, there sometimes is mucus. Okay, we wake up in the morning, there's mucus in the corner of our eyes. We should clean that. In the nose, we don't go looking for anything. We don't go into any of the orifices of the body looking for dirt, but sometimes there is dirt. We clean it. Same with the mouth. Sometimes on the teeth. It could be medication. It could have been something, whatever it might be. Wash it. Clean it. We don't go inside. You must take care that the mouth and the nose do not fill with water. I am a very, very, very big on this issue. You'll hear it over and over again. Make sure the eye, the mouth and the nose remain as dry as possible, so you have to be very careful. Now, once the entire head is done, we wash the back of the head. We really don't wash it that well while it's on the lying flat, because you really can't. You can wash it, you can pour water there, but you're not going to really, to lift the head and clean it that way, you really can't see what you're doing. And it also usually means the head is going up and down. So we wash the head as best as we can. We'll go through it once. But in terms of taking care to see what's in the ears, for example, we wait till it's turned, and then we will wash the back of the hair if it really needs washing. But the front of the face is washed immediately. And even the ears, we go through it with a cloth, go into the outer ears. Sometimes there's dirt there. You need to wash the person so that they are clean. Sometimes after you wash, you will see on the face, usually in the crack of the nose, sometimes on the forehead, like a white film. People don't bathe for a long time. It's really, I don't know if it's dead skin or it's just dirt, whatever it is. You should wash that away. And then you continue down. The minhag is we start again with the right, we do the neck, and then we do the arm. We lift the arm, and we do the inner arm. We wash the entire arm. As I said before, this is an area where there could be sensitive skin. It's an area we want to make sure there's no tape. Very often there are different tubes that are put in, intravenal tubes, medication, whatever it might be that are put into the arm, and there could be residue of tape. You can use tape removers, whatever it is that will remove it. There's a lot of different things. On our website, we have some things that you might want to look at. But whatever it is, it's something that is certainly appropriate to use. Or just lukewarm water. If you know how to do it and you're careful, it comes off pretty readily most of the time. Okay, now, so you go down. Here again, the hands. Very, very, very often, the hands will have a layer of dirt. Call it dead skin. Someone didn't wash for a long time. There's a buildup on the hands of dead skin. If you feel it, as you go with your gloves. By the way, when you're wearing gloves, this is a tikkun. What? Right, I'm saying, when you're wearing gloves, wear the right size. a tikkun. You should wear gloves that fit you tightly. Why? Because if you do, you have a sense of feel. If you don't wear tight gloves, first of all, they'll fill with water, especially if you're using a mikveh, but even without, they'll get water in them. It becomes uncomfortable for everybody. But on top of that, you have no sense of things that are creams that are there, dirt that's there. You want to have a sense of feel. So that's a tikkun. That's something that's appropriate. It's covered on mace. So now you clean the hands. The person on the right side continues with the chest. The navel should be cleaned. Sometimes it needs to be cleaned. If it looks fine, you don't have to, again, you don't have to go searching, but if there's dirt there, you should remove it. And then you continue. The private areas are done on the right side. You uncover that part just to clean there appropriately. Sometimes there are creams there. People have sensitive skin in that area. Sometimes there's different creams. You have to clean them off as best as possible. And it could usually be done without injuring the person further if you know how to do it appropriately. And then continue down the leg. Same thing at the end. The feet very often have a buildup of dirt. You want to make sure that you clean that well. Okay? And that's the right side. So you have one person pouring back in, person in front of them washing, and that's how they wash the right side. The people on the left side can start. This is a kula. Technically, the whole right, then the whole left, but it's a kula. If the people on the right begin, people on the left can start right after. However, they must always maintain the position of being behind the right. So if on the right side suddenly there's some tape that has to be taken care of, the right, left side has to stop. If there's something bleeding on the right side and they have to take care of it, the left side has to stop. Once you are done cleaning the body, the hands and the feet, then you can clean the nails. Not talking about nail polish. Nail polish should be done in the survey. Because once you pour water, it's very hard to clean nail polish, okay? So that should be done in the survey. But otherwise, the cleaning of the nails should be done when that part of the body has already been washed. So after you wash the hands, you clean the nails. Usually we use some kind of, what they use professionally to clean nails. Or you can use a toothpick. That's a sandwich toothpick. We actually found a place that has sandwich toothpicks that don't have little frills on top. I think we actually can order it with us. There's only one place that still makes them. But sandwich toothpick is good, or you could use something that's professional that you get in the store that is meant for cleaning nails. But we generally use wood. We don't use metal. I'm not sure why, but that's the way it is. Now, so when you're finished washing the hands, you can have someone clean the hands. For example, you have extra people. Someone's working on the foot, and it's all taking long. There's an extra person. They could be cleaning the hands at that time, cleaning the fingernails at that time. Now, there's a minute in some chevers to do negelwasser. After they wash the hands and the feet, they pour water. I didn't see it by you. We don't do it either. No, it exists. No problem. Now, once you are done with washing the entire front of the body, you then move to the back. Now, to me, turning a body is an art. Actually, pouring is also an art. You have to know how much to pour. You know, I used to have someone in the chevra used to dip in. I mean, it used a lot of water. Baruch Hashem, most of the time we have enough water. It's not the issue, but it's just impossible to clean like that. You have to pour. Sometimes you have to pour a little heavier, sometimes a little slower. You have to pour on the spot or right above the spot. There are different ways. There's an art. Look to see what works best and learn it. It's all part of Kavod HaMeis. Makes you a better Matar, a better Mataharit. That's the way it goes. Now, there's the way to turn a body. Now, I'll show you how I was shown to turn a body when I first started the Kavod HaMeis. Basically, if I was turning the body towards me here, lift the arm, take it like this, take the hip, and pull towards you. That's how I was taught to turn the body. Now, let me tell you what happened almost invariably. And that was that A, the body would be right up against me. And sometimes it was very, very heavy because I'm really supporting almost the full weight of the body while the person on the other side is washing. Very hard. On top of that, if there's a groove in the table on all the Tahara tables where the water runs down, when you have the body right up against here, it's not going to run down. It pools here because it can't go through. On top of that, sometimes you open a puncture in this position because it's up against you, and then suddenly you're looking and you see red water running down towards the hole because you never saw it. Okay. Also, sometimes there's stuff purging. The head might be a little further down by the way. You never turn the body to face it down, but if it's facing on the side and there is something internally that's bleeding, you may not even see it because you have no vision. You have no view. You're blocked. That's one reason. There are other reasons. So you have a lot of reasons. I had a lot of problems with my back before my stroke. Actually, I'll tell you, one of the biggest chasve Hashem was my stroke. Because my back was in agony before my stroke. I couldn't walk 10 paces before the stroke. After the stroke, I could walk. Before the stroke, I couldn't. So, Baruch Hashem, I'm not complaining. But the point is that all came about because I did taharas for, I don't know how many thousands, but for years I was doing 3, 4, 5 a day without knowing how to stand right and how to use and lifting bodies like this. So it's a chesed for everyone involved to learn how to turn the body properly. But it's also a chesed to the person you're doing because you can do a much better time. So let me show you what I recommend. What I recommend is that the person is always moved to the far side of the table so that the side that's going to be exposed is the side that you want as close to that side of the table. Okay? So we never move a body like this, but I'm just showing you. Someone would be holding the head, absolutely supporting the head before you move a body, ever support the head. Okay? And there'd probably be two people moving this, but we would slide the person over to that side of the table, as far as it goes. Okay? We're turning it this way. Then raise the hand onto the chest so that it's not dragging, not going in the other direction. Raise the leg over the other leg so that it's not going in the opposite direction. Okay? It's working. We're working with you. Now, I always say the person who turns, okay, the person who turns is going to be turning by holding the shoulder and the pelvic area. These two places. That's where the greatest amount of weight is, and that's the easiest place to turn. So this person, now if you have enough people, someone on the other side could be helping to lift a little bit, so I'm not stretching this far, but that's the way it is. Not all the tables are this wide. That's one of the reasons I want to use that table, because I couldn't show this, okay? Now, I'm doing the work. Consider me the Rebbe. And the Rebbe needs a shamus on the other side. So what you're going to do is, you have a person on this side, and a person on this side whose purpose is only to hold the shoulder and stop it from sliding. So when I turn, having my hand in those two positions, there is someone standing next to me, holding the shoulder, not letting it move. All they're doing is supporting it. Same on the pelvic area. So the person turning has two people on either, one on either side. Again, you have an extra person, they can help from there too. But once you have that kind of support, move this body, move this arm away, so that's not going to be under the body, and you turn like this. Look at the difference. You have complete visibility. I'm not supporting this body. This body is supporting itself. The head is not panav lamata, it's on its side. Okay, and you can do the complete back of the tahar for the people on the other side. First of all, not stretching as far, and they have complete visibility. You have complete visibility. If first of all, you're not on the arm, the chances of blood coming is much less. But if it does, you will see it immediately. You have full view. On top of that, I'm going to mention this: when you are packing rectally, if the body is not like this, it's very hard because the weight of the buttock, of the pelvis, is right on the opening. When you have a body turned and you have to pack, it's much, much easier to do. So there are a million reasons for the people doing Tara and for the body itself to turn the body like this. The trick to doing this is not a big trick. By the way, as soon as the body is turned, the people who helped are gone. It's only me holding this at this point. They just were there for the purpose of helping me get it up, to support, to act as a wedge. But now I'm on my own. This is worth having if you can implement it. The point is, it has to become hergel. It has to become routine. In our chevra, everyone knows when a body's about to be turned. Everyone gets in position. They just do it. There's no thought about it. It's everyone. Is this person too big? Is it big enough? Do we really need it? It's so that he's so light, she's so light. Just do it. That's the routine. And if it becomes a routine, it's very easy. You always remember to do it. Okay? That's the way to turn the body. Then you put the body down, and you reverse yourself. You move the body over this way, and you turn it from the other side. When you're doing using a mikvah, as you put the body. Now, by the way, when you turn the body, of course, you're always turning the other way first. You're turning so that the right side is exposed first. You do the back of the head. Now, when you're doing the back of the head, you check the ear. Sometimes there is wax in the ear that, again, needs to be removed. Sometimes not. The back of the ear. People tell you, wash behind the ears. Yeah, sometimes there's dirt there. Sometimes you wash it. It's when the body is turned. The back of the head, if you need to wash it, that's the time to do it. And you go down. On the right side, you check rectally. And if there's dirt there, you clean it. And if once it's clean, you pack it. Now, the Bedikas Pnim, and I saw it inside. We have not done the Bedikas Pnim probably in years. I mean, I shouldn't say not ever. Once in a few hundred times, maybe. It's almost never. Because if you know how to pack properly, and this is where I myself was did what I tell everybody never to do, and that is don't have the right supplies. There is something called Weberil. Is there anyone here that knows what Weberil is?
Sorry, what is it called?
Weberil. W-E-B-R-I-L. It's the name of the company that produces it. It is cotton.
Maybe just explain what Bedikas
Pnim. Okay, I'll get to that in a minute. Yeah, okay, good. Bedikas Pnim, I'll get it. Thank you, Robert, with you. Okay, I'll do that in a minute. Bedikas Pnim, we were talking before about cleaning rectally. So, basically, sometimes you do a tahara, and it's perfectly clean. I'd say 30, 40% of the time, maybe 50% of the time, there's no problem. Okay? Whatever it is, maybe more, it depends how the person died, if they died in the hospice, they died in the hospital, what kind of conditions they had, all kinds of reasons. Very often, more often than not, maybe you don't have to do anything. But there are times where it's dirty, so you clean it. But you're afraid that it's going to continue to come. Okay? But if it's clean at this point, you take cotton and you pack it. A Bedikas Pnim is an internal cleansing, which is literally an enema. There are Chevres Kadisha that will always do an enema. Now, when they say always, by the way, they don't mean always, because they won't always do it. They will do it if in certain situations when they're afraid to do it, they will not do it. Whatever it is. But technically, their minhag is to do a Bedikas Pnim. Here again, Eretz Yisrael, they do a Bedikas Pnim. The minhag in this country, by and large, is not to do a Bedikas Pnim unless it's necessary. If you can, there are certain people that die, they're impacted. They just haven't gone for a very long time. And when they die, the muscles loosen. And it's very, very hot. Sometimes there are gases inside that actually push it out. So you have no choice but to clean it. You do that with a hose. And you clean it out, and you have to be very careful. You have to know what you're doing. Sometimes you can even fill the stomach or the colon with water. You have to put in just enough to get it out. You don't want to put in too much. You don't want to break through the colon. Whatever it might be, these are things that you learn in the process. Whoever's there will show you. But I will tell you that the need to do a Bedikas Pnim, if you know how to pack, is almost never. You will sometimes have to, again, in these rare cases like I'm talking about, but as a general rule, you can manage with that. Okay? Now, the what to use for packing is very important. Years ago, we used to have this cotton on a roll. Johnson & Johnson, I think, used to produce it. It had like little puffy cotton on a roll. We stopped using that 40 years ago, 30 years ago. We started using it one time. We were using what they have in hospitals. I forget what they're called. It's like pads. What? What? Not gauze. No. Not gauze. It was cotton in some kind of a covering. Whatever it is. We don't use that. tell your funeral director that you need to get Webril. Webril is towels on a roll. Towels. It looks like a towel, like a paper towels on a roll. Okay? On a roll, this way. Not that way, but this way. It is about this long, and it's perforated, and you pull down a towelette made of cotton, of compacted cotton. It's solid, compacted cotton that's soft, but it's cotton, and it's compacted, and it's in a towelette. And I fold it so that it's half the size, so that instead of being twice as long as it is wide, it's exactly a square. And it pulls in one direction. You can tear it easily in one direction. So you tear it to whatever size you need. Okay? It could be this wide. It could be that wide. Okay? It's a square. It's like about, probably about, maybe, I think it's more than 12 inches. Maybe it's 12 inches wide and 12 inches long. And you just pull down the amount that you need. Just tear the entire length of it. Make a little head to it. And you pack it. And it stays there. And at the end, you make another little head to it so that it's closed off. Sometimes you need a thinner piece, sometimes you need a thicker piece. You get to learn how much. And it stays there. And that's it. Can I tell you, there were three cases that I had. We have many more, but three that I remember for a man where we did a tahara on a body that came from Eretz Yisrael. Someone died in Eretz Yisrael. They wanted to be buried here, and they came from Eretz Yisrael. The first time, we didn't know what to expect. We wondered, did they do a tahara? Didn't they do a tahara? They did a tahara. And in every single case, it was packed with this type of cotton. Okay? And this was years ago already. They got it before we got it. Okay? But anyone my chaver knows, you never use anything but Webril. We sell it actually at a loss. I think we just raised our price because the price for cotton went sky high. It's like a roll is like $15, but big deal. A roll could last for a very, very, very long time. That's what you use to pack the mouth, to pack a colostomy, to pack a tracheostomy. This is what you use. It makes it, it's a whole different world. Gauze, as good as it might seem, is nowhere compared to cotton. It doesn't have the absorbency, doesn't have all kinds of things. You can't make it to the same size. This is the way to go. So if I came here to teach you about Webril, ask your funeral director. I give you my word. I'm willing to bet that in his prep room, he's got Webril. Okay? Because they... What? No, no, say you have to buy it. They won't give it. So good to buy it. Look at our website. We'll send it to you. We'll send it to you. It's not a big deal. You have to buy whatever. Take it, whatever you need. Thank you very much. We'll take a break and we'll pick up afterwards.
You want another coffee?
Please. I'm not. I'm just making my practice. It is.